Reasonable. It's the reasonable. It's the reasonable. It's the reasonable. Coming to you every day.
Welcome back to the Reset Rebel podcast with me, Jo Yule. And today's guest has been documenting dance music and rave culture since June 1989, spurred into action after reading the inaccurate and often hysterical tabloid reports of the acid house party scenes he'd just attended. Although he had no journalistic experience and could only type with two fingers, his injustice-fueled, sweat-soaked dispatches from the dance floor reached a new generation through the Clubbers Bible Mix Mag. As their raving reporter, he witnessed firsthand the explosion of rave culture, a sonic shockwave which ripped through Western Europe, beyond Paris, Rimini through war-torn Yugoslavia, beyond the Iron Curtain to Soviet-era Moscow, and heralding a revolution and a change, a rave new world, which is, of course, the title of his relatively new book, but it's also coming out on paperback in June. I'm joined by Mr. Kirk Field. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. Nice to meet you.
Finally.
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, I've been itching to meet you after spotting your incredibly bright yellow book on my friend's bookcase just very recently in his bathroom, I might add. And I didn't turn the pages whilst on the porcelain bust. But I would like to say that I haven't actually quite finished reading it yet, but it was a great start. And I immediately reached out to you to see if we could get this little conversation happening.
That's right, you did. And I was very positive. And I said, well, next time I'm over, I'll drop in, I'll get in touch with you and let's do it. So here we are. I hired a scooter just for you.
I'm just so glad that you're in one piece and your hair looks gorgeous after that little helmet incident.
Helmet hair. It's not a good look, is it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, like most of Ibiza
look. Hair for a podcast.
You've got great hair for a podcast. That's very, very true.
Hey, I've just got hair. I'm 62 next week. I've got hair. That's enough.
I'm amazed that you've still got hair after all the raving you've done. I mean, it's still attached to your actual head.
Yeah, you don't lose your hair. You lose your sanity and you lose your wisdom and you lose your teeth through chewing gum. And you lose your hearing. I've got really bad tinnitus, but my hair is still there.
As long as your hair is fabulous, that's the main thing. Your crowning glory. I mean, you do look pretty good for all the obviously the parties that you have attended. But you know, let's start at the beginning because I really like the intro in the book where you sort of said that you know one of the reasons you wanted to write it was so that your sort of you know your children could read it and actually kind of get a bit of a grasp on what you actually got up to without having to tell them face to face, which I thought was quite amusing.
Well, yeah, I think that's a dilemma for any parent that was involved in the rave generation because, you know, we've got a choice. Are we hypocrites? Do we say to people, don't do this, don't do that? Or are we honest? Do we say, look, we did that when we were young and there's a difference between recreational drugs and habitual drugs and some drugs are better than others and all of those kind of things. And so having two teenage sons who are embarrassed at even being in the same room as me, I realised I was never going to probably have that conversation. So I thought the best way to do it is to put it all down on a... And I thought it was going to be in a USB stick in a drawer. And after I went to the great after party in the sky, I thought they might find it and then put it in and go, oh, this is what the old man used to do. I didn't, in my wildest dreams, expect it to be published. It wasn't written to be published. If I'd written it to be published, it probably wouldn't be as honest as it is. So that's probably a good thing. So the audience was primarily myself to cheer myself up in lockdown, but also my two sons. So it was really important to be really authentic and to be genuine and to tell them the truth, which is what the book is.
Well, I think that's a really nice way for them to kind of, you know, read the full gory details, which I can't wait to get into later. Now you've very kindly brought me a copy, actually. How did the event go last night when you were talking about rave culture down in San Antonio at the San Remo Hotel?
Yeah, that was for Slip Back in Time. Slip Matt was the very first DJ that I interviewed in October 1989. And I did a little thing. And I interviewed him, and we've kept in touch. And of course, he's now considered the godfather of rave, and he knows I'm doing a spoken word thing. So he invited me out, and he said, "Do you want to talk to my crew?" He's got 500 people over here for a thing called Old School Ibiza or Slip Back in Time, and it's my demographic. You know, we call them the gravers. It's like ravers who are grey. And so I did a talk last night. I do this presentation thing. I call it it's either acid house storytelling, like it was last night, which is acid house anecdotes and tales of revolution back in the day, or if there's a screen present and I can use music as well, there's another show called Acid House Cabaret, which I'll talk to you about a little bit later on. But as regards last night, it was really good. You know, I tell these old stories, and it speaks their language, and it hopefully bring, you know, I call it a strobe down memory lane. You know, and it sort of, just like the book, I guess, it will appeal to anyone who lost themselves in the lasers in the 90s, or can't quite remember whether they lost themselves in the lasers in the 90s. And so it went down really well. It was my kind of group, all over 50s, and they really enjoyed it. Well, they laughed in the right places. Let's put it that way.
I mean, you said that you originally, got into the rave scene because you were staying with a friend and a random phone call popped up one day and you just happened to pick up the telephone. This is as far as I did get in the book, but I love this story about, you know, kind of taking this order for thousands of bottles of, non-alcoholic drinks for an event. And he obviously thought you'd completely screwed up the order. So how did that kind of like evolve and materialise into you running a bar in these massive giant raves?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was homeless at the time, and so my mates just said to me, you can stay on my sofa as long as you do the hoovering once a week and answer the phone. I said, well, who are you expecting to call? And he said, we've just set up this mobile bar business and we'll be doing bar mitzvahs and posh weddings and things for people. And so we got this call on the very first day and I took all the details down, and he came in from work and in a really bad mood. And he read it back and he's going like, right, what's this? 2,000 to 3,000 people? You mean 200 to 300 people? What's this, from 12 till late? You mean, well, that's got to be midday to late. I said, no, he said midnight to late. Midnight? It must be a kid's party. I said, well, why do you say that? He goes, well, it says here they want Ribena, Lucozade, water, and no alcohol. So obviously it must be a kid's party. So it just completely messed up, Kirk. You had one job to do. And so I was really quite down about it. I went out for a run. And I came back, and then Adam said, "Oh, do you want a cup of tea? Do you want a cup of tea, babe? I'll put some toast on for you." And he was all over me. I said, "Well, hello, Adam. What's that?" He goes, "No, you were right. You're completely right about it. It was 2,000 to 3,000 people. It was midnight till late, and it was just soft drinks." I said, "Well, what kind of party is that then?" He goes, "Ah, I think I know what kind of party it is." He goes, "The Batman film's just finished being shot up at Pinewood with like Christian Slater and things, and it's a rap party. The end of the film, and they have this big party for all the crew and everything." He goes, "I think that's what it is." I went, "Oh, bloody hell. I can't go out. I promised I'd take my girlfriend out, my ex-girlfriend out on Saturday to meet Lemmy, you know, from Motorhead, because she put me up for 3 weeks on her sofa. So that was the deal. I'll introduce you to Lemmy, because my mate run a club in the West End in Soho, and Lemmy used to go and drink there every Friday. So I missed that first party, fully thinking I'd missed the Batman rap party. And I went back on the Sunday. I went up to the flat that we share, and all I could hear was, "Oh yeah, keep it locked, center 4-2-3, keep coming up, going with the infield crew." And I opened the door, and he was like, in his, you know, didn't have a shirt on, and he was like doing his funny dance, his funny octopus dance. And I was like, "All right, Adam." He goes, "Yeah, mate." He goes, I said, "How was the party?" "Ah, oh, it wasn't a Batman party. It wasn't a Batman party. It was one of them acid house parties. It was one of them acid house parties, and everybody takes this thing called E. Everybody just loves each other, and there's no judgment going on. The music's absolutely fantastic. I've never, ever seen anything like it. This thing's going to change the world." And I was like, "Fucking hell, how on earth can something like that change the world?" He goes, "You've got to come to the next one." Anyway, 35 years on, he was right. It did change the world. So I went the next week, and every single weekend through that summer, I was working behind the bar, selling the bottles of water and the Ribena and the Lucozade. Just having 4 hours on and 4 hours off, then we'd go and rave and everything. And the only reason why I started writing about it for Mixmag was because the way that the tabloids covered it, you know, the greatest parties I'd ever been to were really etched in my mind and really changing my life. And then on Monday, I'd go down to the newsagents and see, "Worst ever, children as young as 12 taking the mind-bending drug ecstasy." There was no one aged 12 at the raves. It was 25 quid to get in. It was 15 quid for a pill. It was in the middle of nowhere, so you needed a car or someone who knew where a car was and someone who had a pager. You know, not many 12-year-olds had pagers or cars at that time in the 80s. And so the average age of people at the raves was sort of late 20s, early 30s. It was a real sort of young urban professional thing from London. And so I saw all the lies that had been written about this beautiful experience that I was having, and I decided to just put the record straight. So I wrote with I borrowed a typewriter, and I just had two fingers in the truth, and I just tapped out on my girlfriend's old Oliver A typewriter about why people went to raves. The fact that there's no dress code, the fact that bouncers didn't beat you up, the fact that girls could dance and talk to guys without, you know, getting groped or thinking that they've got to get off with them. It wasn't about that. It wasn't about trapping off, as we called it in the North. And there was no judgment. There was no judgment between black, white, Asian people, gay, straight. It didn't matter. It didn't matter about the colour of the skin, your social strata. Everybody was one. Everybody sharing water. Everybody dancing to the same tunes. And when you've experienced that unity, you never forget it. It never leaves you. And you want to share that. You know, and we became evangelical about that. And, you know, I was evangelical in introducing lots of my friends to that lifestyle. And also, you know, I wrote about it for Mix Mag. They picked up on my feature. And the response to my feature, because at that stage, Mix Mag was doing a lot of turntable stuff, a lot of hip-hop, soul, jazz, funk, all that kind of stuff. And I was the first person to cover the rave scene for Mix Mag. And so they sent me out to Sunrise, and then every single month after that, I'd send in dispatches, and then it got really interesting. Then they started going, "Well, what are you doing next week?" And I was on the dole. I was on the dole. I was like, Dave Seaman had ring me up. I go, "What are you doing next week, Kurt?" I said, "Well, I've got to sign on Wednesday." "Why?" "Oh, are you free to go to Moscow for 5 days? From Thursday to..." "Yeah, I'll do that, yeah. How much do I get paid?" He goes, "Well, a three-page feature, so we'll give you £150 and your flight and hotel's paid for." And at the time, I got like 32 quid a week dole money. So I was like, yeah, I'll do that. So life was just a big adventure. So my only regret from that time is that I didn't take a decent camera. I used to buy these disposable cameras for £4.99 at Heathrow and just go and click. Invariably, I lost all of those cameras. And so I've got no photographic record of any of those things. I mean, I've got the flyers and the features, but sadly, there's not that many photographs from that era. But, you know, what I had was a ringside seat as rave culture exploded across the planet. You know, Tunisia, Russia, Croatia, Ibiza. You know, I came out here in 1990. They sent me out to interview Bridget Nielsen because she was launching a pop career. And she was Sylvester Stallone's girlfriend at the time. And she had a big, really big profile. And so she was doing a show at Coup, now it's called Privilege. And so she was on 808 State. A guy called Nick Kamen was on. Spandau Ballet, I think, were on. And it was all about, it was a show that was to celebrate the 1992 Olympics that were going to be held in Barcelona. And so they flew me over. And Big Audio Dynamite were on. And there's quite a funny story in the book about what happened with me and Big Audio Dynamite and Aztec Camera, which involves something in my shoe, something in my sock, which I didn't know was in my sock. You have to read the book to find out. But it all ends up... It basically all just spirals into chaos, like a lot of the adventures do, because I wasn't really that professional. And I was just writing about it from a... Now they call it gonzo style. You know, it was really immersive. I really immersed myself in that experience. But at the time, I didn't know it was gonzo. At the time, I just went, I've got a free weekend in Ibiza. I've got 5 days in Moscow with Guru Josh. I'm going to have a great time. And so, you know, in Moscow, it got to a stage where we tried to administer LSD to Boris Yeltsin. We had an audience with Boris Yeltsin, who was the prime minister at the time. And so that came out of the conversations that we all have. We all have those dawn conversations, don't we? When everybody is in a really relaxed, serene state, and we all go, "Do you know what? If all the world leaders just did what we'd done tonight, there wouldn't be any trouble in the world. Everybody would just love each other, and everybody would just like forget all the differences, forget squabbling over borders, and just realise there's more that binds us together than separates us." And then you make a vow that if I could only administer a psychedelic to a world leader, if ever I'm in that situation, I'll do it. Well, I was in that situation where I had an opportunity to do that with Josh in Moscow and Boris Yeltsin, and you have to read the book to find out what happened.
Well, there's a cliffhanger, if ever I heard one, for sure. I mean, when you first started writing, I mean, I love this idea that, you know, you wanted to set the record straight, because I think, you know, we're still seeing the same kinds of ridiculous stories in the papers now. A lot of the time, there's a lot of rubbish, particularly in the Daily Mail, for example. You know, and I think it's sad that these kind of narratives are obviously laid down and then there's no kind of questioning over them. I'm not talking necessarily about nightclub culture, but, you know, that obviously led to, I think, a lot of London's, like, most iconic venues being shut down, the Cross and the End and all of the really, really, really good clubs are kind of, like, no longer in existence. So I think it's interesting that you know, decided to kind of throw your hat into the ring and you know, take on the British press, who are notorious, I think, for, you know, not really portraying things in perhaps the most correct of lights.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, when the book came out, I was determined to... I did a lot of, awful lot of research on the book, you know, for example, as much as though it's there's humorous anecdotes in there, well, hopefully humorous anecdotes, and some real, real cracking tales. There's also, as regards to social history, I realised that, especially with 1989, I had a duty to tell that from the floor upwards, because quite a lot of the detached journalists who have written books about that era weren't at those raves. They weren't at those raves. You know, I know for a fact they weren't at that those raves. A lot of, you know, the other books that have come out on that scene are written by superstar DJs or by promoters. And not always, but often, they have to pull their punches because they don't want their management make sure that they don't say anything that might restrict their entry into the United States, who are very strict about recreational drug use. Now, I've got no such conditions enforced on me. So I was actually, I wrote about it from a raver's perspective. Now, I wanted to give the journalists, I tracked down the journalists that wrote those stories, you know, children as young as 12, taking the mind-bending drug ecstasy, and at the end of the rave at Ecstasy Airport, there were thousands of ecstasy rappers littering the floor. Ecstasy rappers? Who? You know, I say in my show, like, oh, I'm sure there's quite a few people here that have experienced their ecstasy. You don't have to put your hands up, but please put your hand up if you know anyone that's ever bought an E in a wrapper. And I've done 25 shows and no one's ever put their hand up yet. So, you know, this was just nonsense. And so I wanted to give the people that wrote those stories a right of reply. And so I wrote to a girl called Ruki Sayad, who's now one of the cash queens of the Daily Mirror, consumer person. And also another guy, I forget his name now, works with Daily Express, still mired in the tabloids. And I gave them, I said, look, I'd really like to meet you and talk to you. I'll give you final approval. I'd like you to tell your story. Did you really think there was children as young as 12 there? Or was that something that was added by the sub-editors? Because this is really important, because the tabloid reaction to the raves triggered the government to bring in legislation that stopped people from dancing, and the increased penalties bill, you know, the Graham-Bright bill of March 1990. And so it was a fundamental shift in public opinion. Up until then, the Sun was giving away smiley T-shirts, and it was all like, join the new dance craze, Acid House. And then they just changed, and then suddenly dance music became the folk devil, you know, some sort of evil cult luring young children away like a Pied Piper, really. And so I wanted to give them the right of reply, and they completely ignored me. They completely ignored all my emails, and eventually Ruki got back to me and said, look, I do have my up assistance, but I'm not interested. They're just not interested in contributing. And I'd be really interested to know why they're not interested in contributing, because I think it'd be great if they said, OK, listen, I was a 19-year-old, I wanted to work for the Sun, I had no money, and they sent me out to this rave, and what appeared in print wasn't at all what I wrote. You know, I wanted a more balanced thing, because I think it came down from the top. I think there was definitely a movement from the Parliamentary Drinking Party, you know, the lobbying, the breweries lobbying group, because the amount of under 24-year-olds that were drinking in pubs in 89 and 90 actually went down for the first time. It went down by 11%. It's the first time, 1989, that the amount of alcoholic drinks consumed by under 24-year-olds went down. And this worried them, because a generation was choosing another drug that wasn't alcohol. And that worried them. So I know for a fact there was lobbying there done to the government. And also, obviously, a lot of the raves went on in the home counties, which is Conservative, it's Tory heartland. And so, you know, when you're keeping the Tories awake, you know, they're going to know someone in government to say, look, you know, we can't sleep, though these villages have been terrorised. And so that was a really easy vote winner for them. And so the government was under a lot of pressure, but the tabloids certainly helped that. But what I'd like to know is, were they told to turn against Acid House, or was them turning against Acid House and the dance music movement trigger legislation in the government to act? And I'd like to find out, but they won't talk. The tabloid journalists won't talk.
Well, we'll never know which came first, the chicken or the egg. But I guess, you know, one thing usually follows the other. I mean, obviously, free parties in Ibiza were, you know, happening, I guess, in the kind of hippie times. I mean, I've had Rob DeBank on the podcast before. He told us, you know, a little bit about the very, very, very first free parties that he was throwing in Ibiza. Have you ever been to any raves on the island back in the day?
Yeah, I mean, in the north there used to be a big sort of trance scene, and there was some amazing parties up there in caves and on cliff tops and things like that that was put together. But that was rumoured to have been snuffed out by the Discoteca Association. They didn't want people dancing for free, so you know that kind of put paid to that. But I think that I think Ibiza's really obviously. Ibiza was really instrumental in sort of 87, 88, you know, with the Ibiza 4 coming over and importing it back. But I think that as the 90s went on, it became like a rite of passage. I mean, I think Ibiza became it started off as a secret, and then it became a destination, and now it's morphed, rightly or wrongly, into a brand and all that goes with that. And, you know, I don't want to be one of these people that's here going, oh, it's not as good as it used to be, because the world's full of people like that and things change. And I think that we get the Ibiza we deserve. And I think if you're going to charge €37 for a chicken Caesar salad and people buy it, then that chicken Caesar salad is going to be €42 next year. So, you know, you can't blame them for putting up, because if they can get away with it, they'll keep doing it. So it's the people that are coming out here and paying those prices that's driving it. So Ibiza's changed a lot, I think. And but back in the day, you know, there was quite a healthy party scene, a free party scene, which obviously was not allowed to continue.
No, and actually I was at the International Music Summit a couple of weeks ago, and we were actually listening to an interview with Pete Tong and Abel Matutis, who is obviously one of the king linchpins who owns kind of like half of Clubland on Ibiza. And it was utterly fascinating to listen to the conversation about, you know, how things got shut down, really, in terms of like the open air clubs and obviously the closure of space, and then, you know, how they turned it into high, and now they've brought Coup, which is now privilege, as we know. And obviously their plans to kind of reopen that next year, next summer, at the beginning of the summer, because obviously they've got this title of like best club in the world for high, but apparently Coup is going to be the best club in the world. So I recorded the conversation just because I wanted to listen back to it, but I'm sorely tempted to pop it out on this podcast. I might have to get some permission for that. But it was honestly, I was gripped for a whole hour listening to what he had to say.
Well, it's funny you should mention Coup, because in the paperback that's coming out, there's three extra chapters. It's called The Extended Mix. There's three new chapters. And one of those chapters is set in Ibiza, and it's in 1992, I think it was, when I came out in early season. It was like late May, early June. And I went to M15 Records. Gianfranco and Pipi, I used to hang out there. I used to just knock around with those guys all the time. And I said, what's the latest on the island? What's happening at Coup tonight? He went, no, Coup's closed. I'm like, what? Yeah, Coup's closed there. They didn't pay their drinks bill last year. They didn't play their suppliers. So it's closed. And I was like, what? But dance music's taking off all over Europe. Didn't they get the memo of all the seasons to be closed? And so I couldn't resist getting on my scooter and driving up to Coup. And it was, you know, it's empty, just like it is now. And it was derelict and things like that. I mean, I know there's building work going on, but back in 92, there wasn't. And there was an open window. There was a window that had been smashed. And so I climbed through the window, and it was like these shafts of light were coming through. It was like sort of Indiana Jones. And the party, the big set from the final party from last year, there had been a pop video made, and it was still there. It was a huge, big centrepiece on the stage. And there was bits of flotsam and jetsam floating in the pool, the swimming pool that was there. And there was piles of dog dirt all over. And that should have been a warning sign, because I just wanted to sing. I thought I'm in the middle of the world's biggest club, great big reverb. So I walked to the front of the middle of the dance floor, and it was just, it was birds in the, you know, in the height of the roof. I'm completely on my own in the world's biggest club, and I just thought, I only get a chance to do this once. So it's 3 a.m. eternal. And just at that point, this dog appeared from nowhere, and it's like this huge big Doberman. I'm like, oh my God. So I jumped over the bar and I hid in a cupboard behind one of the bars. This blinking dog was outside barking and snarling. And so the chapter is for that chapter, it's called Alone in the World's Biggest Club. And it's about how I got out the, it's about whether I got out of the cupboard or not. But obviously I did get out of the cupboard because I'm here telling the story. But it's how I got out of the cupboard. Bearing in mind, I didn't have a mobile phone. It was the days before mobile phones. I'm scared of dogs. You know, I didn't have any weapons or anything like that. So it's how I got out of the club. And so I divulge it for the first time in the new chapter.
Well, once again, I can't wait to read it. I mean, I think, you know, it's a very interesting time that you were probably coming to Ibiza, obviously back in the 90s. I mean, I don't think I started coming here till the early 2000s when I hit my 20s, and that was it, really. The love affair was born. But I think, you know, obviously the Brits really are kind of responsible, I think, in a large part, not completely, obviously, but for bringing rave culture to the island and for creating, you know, a lot of the scene that exists here.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a contentious point, because I think the best thing about Ibiza in the early 90s was that it was a mixing point. You had Italian promoters, Spanish promoters, French promoters and British promoters. And I think Pasha then started becoming very Anglophile, and it was, I think, five or six nights a week. It was English promoters, it was British promoters. And I think that was, as much as that was great for Ibiza in terms of the British market, I think it lost some sort of cosmopolitan, Balearic sensibility. But by that, having like Sunday Central one night and Renaissance the next night, and all of these, Renaissance wasn't there, it was up at Coup actually, privilege as it was then. But, you know, I think that it's important to have a balance. And I think Ibiza has always been a melting point of cultures. You know, it's kind of midway between Europe, and it's got one foot in Europe and one foot in North Africa. And there was a big Moorish influence. I think for about 400 years, the Moors ruled Ibiza. So that cultural melting pot aspect of it is really key to the island's development. And I think in the 90s, my own point of view is it became too Anglophile, it became too British, leaning too heavily on the British thing. But, you know, at the end of the day, that was the heyday. I mean, I remember coming out in 98. I came out in 98 to do a feature for Time Out, I think it was. And I found out that Diego Maradona was on the island. And I realised that Diego Maradona hadn't done an interview with a British journalist since the famous Hand of God goal in 1986. So this is like 11 years on. So 12 years on. And he hadn't talked to a British journalist. And so this guy called Stefan, who used to put the parties on in the north that we talked about earlier, big trance parties, lovely German guy called Stefan. He used to run a cafe just off Parque de la Place in Ibiza town. And so I got talking to him, and he mentioned that Diego Maradona was going to come in that night to do a private to have a private party for our birthday or something like that. And so I went back to San Antonio, got my recorder, came back, drove through on my scooter, got through at midnight, and waited and waited and waited. I waited like for 4 or 5 hours, and Diego didn't show, so I went back on my scooter, and Stefan called me the next day. I called Stefan the next day. He said, yeah, he's coming in tonight instead. So I drove her again. So for 3 nights in a row, I drove over to try and get this interview with Diego Maradona. And I ran out of money in the end. So I can't believe I actually had to go. I took the flight home instead of staying out, you know. And I got home. And just as I got in, there was an answerphone message waiting for me from Stefan, saying, Kirk, you're here. He's here. He's here. He's willing to talk to you. So I missed out on the Diego Maradona interview, and Gary Lineker finally got that interview many years later. He finally talked to his first English journalist, because he wouldn't talk to them about obviously because of the Falklands Malvinas situation. But Stefan said to me, "You are not like any English person I've met. You are not like a typical British man. I will tell Diego about you. Maybe he will talk to you." So almost, but not quite.
And he's no longer with us, no?
No, he's gone to the great after show in the sky. But, I mean, he just left. I mean, there's loads of stories in the book about what he did when he was over here. You know, he was in Pasha one moment. He walked off with some drums and some toms. I saw him walking down the beach, juggling a football. But wherever Diego Maradona went, he was fated on. You know, he's in Latin culture, he was like a god.
Well, rightly so. I mean, God, he was God gifted in so many ridiculous ways. What a life. So, in terms of other, you know, Ibiza connections, you had the Bridget Nielsen story, where you were obviously chasing after her as well.
Yeah, that one. That just descended into utter chaos. So I can't really start telling that story, because that's a whole chapter. But you know, it was just, I guess the thing about the 90s, and anyone that's listened to this will hopefully it'll resonate with you. In the 90s, there was a sense of optimism. That's why the book's called Rave New World, right? As much as it's a play on titles, we actually felt in the early 90s that things were changing, and things were changing. The Berlin Wall came down. There was the Velvet Revolution. Vaclav Havel came into a former playwright was then now the president of Czechoslovakia. Borders were dissolving. A new sensibility was sweeping the world. A new drug was sweeping the world that brought people together. And it was a time of hope. We actually felt that things were changing and things were getting better after the dreadful money-orientated 80s and the recession of the early 80s. And so that's why the book's called Rave New World. And I think Ibiza was like that. You kind of felt that it was just exploding, and every season was more, it was bigger than the last one. You know, and I remember walking around San Antonio, and I described it for Time Out as it's like Beirut with a beatbox on every balcony. You know, every balcony was just blaring out. You know, when people used to come away on holiday, they used to bring out these big boom boxes. You used to see them arriving at the airport with these big boom boxes. Every balcony was just like a sound system on. It was amazing to witness, and it was crazy. And that's being curtailed as well, the licensing. You know, you used to go out for 3 days. You know, you'd go out to Manumission. And then you'd go on to space, and then you'd go on to Bora Bora, and then you'd be invited to a private party, and then you'd be invited to another private, and it just used to go on and on and on, and it was utterly crazy, and I'm really glad that I witnessed that part of it. Mm. And you know, I wouldn't be able to do that these days with my tinnitus.
I think I actually have the early onset of tinnitus as well. My ears have been ringing for the last month. I have actually been out more this month than I think I've ever been out in Ibiza. I don't know what has happened since the opening party started. Yeah, no, I have been out a lot more than usual, but I've been really very much enjoying myself. And I've been to things that are worth going out for, like Laurent Garnier was here a few weeks back at Akasha. And yeah, ever since then, my ears, every morning when I wake up, it's the first thing that I here is this just mild sort of buzzing in the background. It's a thing of beauty. How long have you had that for?
Sorry?
The tinnitus.
Sorry?
I fell for it. Oh my God. This is terrible.
I think it started when I went to Energy in 1989, and there's some photographs with the sound truck. We used to put the sound system on flatbed lorries, flatbed trailers, and it used to tow a generator. And so literally, they used to just hook it up and then sort of take the tarpaulins up. And so we never used to put the sound system into the venue. You just used to pull the you either drive the flatbed trailer into the aircraft hangar or park it outside. And so there's some footage of, I think it was Energy Rave at a Suffolk airfield. I think it was called Dance 89. And it was in September. Beautiful weather. In the book, I talk about that's when I met Grief Rhys Jones, because he lived next door to the airfield. So he was wandering around the airfield, and he goes, "I've never been to an acid house party before." So I was chatting to him, and the conversation's related. We told him in my book, but I think it was that time, because I was actually dancing on the flatbed trailer right in front of the speakers for a good few hours. So I don't think my ears have been the same since then. And so I do say, you know, and that's for a serious point, you know, when you do get tinnitus, it's a case of managing it. You know, John Carter, DJ John Carter, took me to one side when we first getting quite bad, because I work on a thing called Snow Bombing, an Alpine music festival, which I've worked on for 20 years. And I was doing this backcountry party, and John Carter was there, and he took me to one side and he sat me down. He said, "Look, you know, I've got good news and bad news about tinnitus. I've had it for 12 years. I went, "All right." I said, "What's the bad news?" He goes, there's no cure. I said, "Right." I said, "So what's the good news?" He goes, "You will learn to manage it." And I was like, "Right." And I said, "What's the alternative?" Because if you don't learn to manage it, it'll drive you mad. So you're going to have to learn to manage it. And you will learn to manage it. And he was right. You have got to learn to manage tinnitus. And there's a lot of people, a lot of former ravers and a lot of DJs, early DJs that now all the DJs I know have you know, ear protectors. But back in the day, they didn't. And the thing about the raves was there was no... Obviously, these were unlicensed parties, yeah? And so because there's no licence, that means there was no sound restrictions on the big orbital raves. And so they were very, very loud, very loud indeed. And then it became, you know, every flyer would be like, 40 kilowatt turbo sound rig. And the next one would be 55 kilowatt turbo sound rig. 80 kilowatt, you know, they were all trying to outdo each other. So it was very, very loud indeed. In fact, it got to a stage where when I was in the Panasonic warehouse on New Year's Eve in 1989, it was so loud because, you know, the Panasonic warehouse was just rattling. The whole thing was just like a huge big tin can. There was no carpets or anything to, or soft furnishings to soak up the sound. And so this DJ was playing. I was on a pile of bricks just dancing. It was the dance podium. And this DJ was playing and he was absolutely killing it. He was absolutely slaying it. And I said to my friend Sarah, I said, Sarah, who's this DJ? And of course you couldn't see the DJ in those days. It's not like now where you have a big altar with the DJ making little heart signs and everybody makes the heart signs back. And the DJ then puts his hand in the air and everybody else puts their hand in the air. Then the DJ just happens to pick his nose. Everybody else starts picking their nose. You know, it wasn't like that. Back in the day, you wouldn't have a backstage pass because all there was backstage was a trestle table and some hairy-ass technician rolling a spliff. And maybe the DJ's bored-looking girlfriend stood next to him looking glum with a bottle of a can of Ribena. So, you know, you never knew who the DJ was. And there was no running order because it all depends whether they got through the roadblocks or not. So you didn't know who was on. It was like, who's here? Oh, Frankie Valentine's on. Frankie, can you go on next? Yeah, I'll do next. Who's there? Face. Gavin, can you go on after Frankie? Well, I've just been on. Well, Jules isn't here, so you're going to have to go on. But if Jules turns up, can you get off and let him on? Yeah, we'll do that. So that's how it was, you know. And so I didn't know who it was that was playing, and he was killing every mix. So I said to Sarah, I said, look, I've got to find out who this DJ was, because I prided myself on being the first to interview these people for Mixmag. So I did the first interview with KLF, with The Orb, with The Shaman, The Grid, the first reports from Ibiza. And so I really prided myself on being having my finger on the zeitgeist. So I wanted to talk to this DJ because he was absolutely brilliant. And every mix was just going to another level. It was absolutely immaculate. So Sarah asked this guy next to him who the DJ was. And so she kind of nodded. And I said, well, who is it? So she looks at me and she just goes, it's DJ Roof Rack. I went, who? She goes, it's DJ Roof Rack. I thought, wow, I've never heard of him before. This is amazing. I've got to get the first interview with Roof Rack. So I waited for him to finish. And so, you know, he finished the set. And again, another 20 minutes. So absolutely brilliant. So I jumped off the pile of bricks and went running over to the trestle table where the trestle table manager was there, because he's now a stage manager, but now he's a trestle table. And I said, can I just mind if I speak to Roof Rack? I want to talk to him for Mixmag. He goes, who? I said, Mixmag. Roof Rack, the guy that's just been playing. He looked at me and went, Kirk, that was Groove Rider. Now, it's that loud. Groove Rack, Groove Rack, Groove Rack, Groove Rack, Roof Rack. And so, luckily, I didn't do an interview with DJ Roof Rack for Mixmag. It was actually Groove Rider. But, you know, that kind of illustrates how loud it was and probably why I've got tinnitus.
I do love Fabio and Groove Rider. I mean, I've been listening to those guys for many, many years. In fact, there's a new little drum and bass night that's started up in Ibiza, a local one in Santillalia, which I was quite pleasantly surprised to witness on the many occasions I've been there now.
Oh, brilliant! I mean, I think this is another thing that's wrong with Ibiza. I think it's too house orientated. You know, drum and bass breaks. You know, I run a trance event, Ibiza trance event in September. About 250, 300 people come over for a week. And the amount of bars that, you know, turn their noses up at having trance in the bars. Oh, we don't want trance. We just want house music. And it's like, that's not what it's about. It should be about embracing all kinds of music and none of this snobbishness of, oh, tech house is better than old school house and it's better than drum and bass. You know, it's not about that. It's, you know, does it move you? Does it make you dance? Does it make you want to stay out and celebrate life and be a, just appreciate what you've got? That's what music should be judged on, not whether it's, you know, it's house music or whether it's trance. Or and so, you know, I don't like that about Ibiza. I think it there's a snobbishness crept in which I combat. You know, I've brought out bounce DJs before, about hard house, you know, happy hardcore groups before. You know, and it's been very difficult to get them into venues because they all want just generic house music. And, it, you know, that's not the attitude, that's not the kind of approach that made Ibiza what it was. It was about tolerance and about trying new things and about the whole Balearic spirit is just to play anything if it sounds good. You know, the whole thing about Balearic music, you know, you'd play indie music, you'd play disco, you'd play hip-hop, you'd play new beat from Belgium. It was all in there. That's what Alfredo created. And I just think it's a shame to see just generic house and tech house played in sort of most places now.
No, I couldn't agree more. I think there's definitely space for the goalposts to be moved a little bit wider. And, you know, that's why my friend Rosie, who started this drum and bass night, I think it's, very, very needed. It was at Somi Art to begin with, but there's another one in June. I'm just giving her a big plug here because it needs a little extra few bodies. I think the next one's on the 22nd of June at the Word of Mouth Radio Cafe. I think, you know, what else did you witness, like when you first started to go to those crazy, massive, you know, to the very, very, very first raves that you can tell us about?
Well, I do like a spoken word thing, as I've said. It's actually just been booked for Edinburgh. It's a 13-night run at the Gilded Balloon, which is one of the top venues in Edinburgh. So I'm doing from the 13th to the 26th of August. And the show's called Acid House Cabaret. And in it, I start off and I list 10 surprising things about the Orbital Raves, you know, and I say, you know, mad stuff, like mad shit happened. Like one night, a BMW 5 Series was auctioned off. Well, not auctioned off, it was raffled off, and people had to pay a tenner for a ticket. And of course, this was the loads of money 80s, the end of the tail end of the 80s. And so these buckets were just going around with people just stuffing fivers and tenners and 20 quids in. Thousands and thousands of pounds were collected for this car that was eventually picked up by some wide-eyed, saucer-eyed, sweat-soaked raver. Who drove it out to a great sort of guard of honour at when the party ended at 8 o'clock in the morning, and when we packed up the bar and we 20 minutes later were trundling out through, you know, past the police lines, and there on the side of the road's a police motorcyclist with a notebook in hand, pen and paper, talking to this guy who was still shimmering and dancing next to the BMW 5 Series, and we can imagine the conversation, can't you? Go, okay, sir, is this your car, sir? Oh, it is now, officer. Have you just bought it, have you, sir? No, I've just won it in a raffle in the rave. Oh, really, sir? That car was stolen from Docklands 6 hours ago. You know, it was like a crazy wild frontier, you know. So it's a joy to talk about what really happened in those raves. You know, I've got 10 things that, you know, that probably haven't been spoken about before. You know, the fact there's no toilets, you know, that wasn't great. The fact there was no toilets, so we'd go into a warehouse or a farmer's field or something, and there was no toilets, you know. And that's what the festival goers, the kind of the travellers, had a real downer on the ravers, because we never used to have spades and shovels to bury the mess we'd made, whereas the travellers would dig a hole and always bury their mess. And of course, the ravers didn't do that because we didn't know where we were going. And we're not going to put a spade in anything. But, you know, that was a real bone of contention between the travelling community and the ravers. And that was maybe one of the reasons why it kicked off in Glastonbury in 1990, which, again, is covered in the book when Mixmag sent me to cover the moment that rave culture hit Glastonbury in 1990. And Happy Mondays played and Adamski played. Adamski was the first dance artist to play the Pyramid Stage. And Paul Oakenfold DJed. And so I was there to witness that, and that all ended up in a massive riot, a big lots of violence happened to such a degree that the festival wasn't on for the next 2 years, and it was almost like the end of old Glastonbury. And then when Glastonbury came back in 93, Orbital played, and, you know, dance music was embraced, and I think Channel 4 were there the following year, 1994, and that's when it became more sort of corporate. And in the book, I talk about 1990 was the end of the Mad Max era, when travellers used to go around, Hell's Angels used to drive around on trike motorcycles at 8 o'clock in the morning, high on acid, and the corporate era, which I've called the Pepsi Max era. So Glastonbury went from sort of Mad Max to Pepsi Max. In fact, I haven't talked about Glastonbury. I'm playing Glastonbury this year, so I'm going to just give that a plug. It's quite special to me because I've been asked to do a talk, Acid House Cabaret, on the Strummerville stage. I'm a big Clash fan, and Joe Strummer's up there with Osho, Jesus Christ, Buddha, Roy Keane, you know, you name it, all the men.
Diego Maradona,
all the men of wisdom. And so I'm playing on Saturdays. If you're at Glastonbury, if this goes out before then, I'm playing on the Strummerville stage at 2:30 on Saturday afternoon. So I'm looking forward to doing that. That's one off the bucket list. All these years later, because the Glastonbury chapter is probably my favourite chapter in the book. It's a lot, you know, lots of stuff happens in Glastonbury. I become the universe, basically.
I banned myself from going to Glastonbury. I think the last time I went there was the early 2000s and bad things happened. I was like, no, can't be trusted to ever return to this field ever again.
Yeah, it's going to be a strange one going back to do a talk. And I'll be talking about, in my show, I'll be talking about Glastonbury in 1990, sort of, you know, 34 years on. Who'd have thought it that 34 years later I'd be going back on a stage and talking about all my adventures? It's a crazy ride I'm on at the moment. It really is. You know, the book wasn't meant to be published. The spoken word show was only done to promote the book because I haven't got a marketing budget. My publishers are not a major publisher. They don't really, well, they are a major publisher, but the amount of budget for my book was limited. And so I realised that I had to get people talking about it and noticing it. And so I thought one thing I can do is talk and perform. And so I decided to do this live show, this one-man show. Last year I did it at Camp Festival and Wilderness Festivals and snow bombing. And then from there it kind of snowballed. And now I find myself talking to a big promoter in the UK and we're going to announce something quite special in early June, which involves UK theatres. It could be a UK theatre tour later on this year for Acid House Cabaret, which would be a first because... You know, maybe authors have done a Q&A before, quite a dry Q&A, but this is the first time that dance music culture and rave culture in particular has actually had its own show in 400 to 500 seater theatres and arenas. And so I'm at the moment signing up some special guests to come in for the second half, and I'll do a Q&A with them. We might do like a Desert Island Disc format or something, and maybe get a DJ in there. There'll be a flyer exhibition in the foyer, so it'll be a real celebration of rave culture, which I think is not my victory, it's the victory for our culture. Rave culture has given me so much, and so it's not just about me. I was very keen to say to the promoters that are putting this together, look, I don't just want it to be a one-man show. I'll do the first part, but in the second half I want to interview some real influential, respected figures from dance music and rave culture. So at the moment I'm in the process of talking to those, so it's going to be quite a big deal later on this year, and you're the first to hear about it.
I'm honoured, and I wish I could come to the Edinburgh Fringe. Actually, I've literally never ever been, and I used to live in Brighton, and we had the Brighton Festival and the Brighton Fringe, and I, you know, that was when the whole town or city used to come alive, and you know, just so many interesting people and amazing little crazy, weird, quirky, terrifying, hilarious incredible shows, and it was just such a fun month in May. And yeah, I think August, I mean, I've never been to Edinburgh either, so maybe I will come and see you.
Well, it'd be great to have someone there that can laugh in the right places.
Because... I could be your plant.
Yeah. The guy said to me, he saw me do something last November, and he said, look, it's perfect for Edinburgh, you've got to come up to Edinburgh, Kirk. I was like, I've never been to Edinburgh Festival, isn't it just stand-up comedians? No, it's all sorts of stuff there, you've got to come. And I said, well, I'll do it, for what you're talking. He goes, look, just 7 nights, it's just a 7-night run, it's a room, no more than 60 people, 58, 60. I said, okay, I can do that. 7 nights, 60 people, I can do that. And it's morphed into 13 nights, 140 seats. I'm like, oh no, but anyway, the people behind it, I've got some really strong allies and partners up there promoting this, and so they, and also I've got a good time. It's 7:30. It's 7:30 in the evening. So apparently, these shows start at 10 o'clock in the morning. Some of the shows start at 10 o'clock in the morning and go on to about 2 o'clock in the morning, and so I've been told that my slot. 7:30 in the evening is kind of prime time, so you know. So if it fails, it's nothing to do with the promotion, or the time, or the venue. It's me.
You've let me down. You've let the family down. You let your sons down.
I said to my wife, I said, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen? I said, you know, worst thing that can happen, because you know I'm a little bit worried about it. It's quite a daunting prospect with 13 nights on the trot. I said, what's the worst that can happen? I asked myself, I thought, well, the worst thing that can happen is that there's only 20 or 30 people there every night, but at the end of the day, they'll still enjoy it because I'll do a good show. That's about the worst that can happen. She goes, no, the worst that can happen is you're not doing it, and then 5 years later, you're in a conversation with somebody that's done Edinburgh, and you go, oh, yeah, I had the chance to do Edinburgh, and I didn't do it. and you've got to say yes to things. And this is, you know, to be serious for a second, I mean, I lost probably my closest friend 2 weeks ago to cancer at the age of 55. And it just brings it back. We're at that age now. It brings it back that, you know, you don't take life for granted. And I just, one of his mantras was to say yes to everything, any opportunities. And it's easy to say no. Oh, I can't do it. I've got to wash my hair. Or, oh, it's a bit far out of my way. Or you can always find a good excuse not to do something. But Chris taught me that you've got to say yes to things. And so I'm saying yes to the Edinburgh Festival. I've said yes to the theatre tour, even though I've got my you know, that's quite daunting as well, 400 to 500 seater theatres. But I'm just saying yes to things because, you know, we're on this planet, we come this way but once, and it's all too fragile and all too short. So we've got to make the most of it while we're here.
I think if it doesn't terrify you senseless, then it's not big enough, your dream, and you should absolutely be going for it. I think that's super, super exciting. I had the opportunity to get on stage and host TEDx in February, and in year one, I think it was 250 people, and this year it was more like 500, and the terror and the nerves were real, but from everything you've said to me thus far, I think you're going to be utterly brilliant.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you very much. Maybe you'll read my book now.
I will, I promise you. It's coming to bed with me tonight.
Well, there's no answer to that, is there? It's nice to be between the sheets.
Indeed, and my little yellow friend.
Not so little, it's quite thick actually.
It's not all about the size, you know.
It's how you read it that counts.
Indeed, or flick through it wildly. Anyway, moving swiftly on from there, I'm not sure in which direction we should head, but I think, I do think that it's that moment in life, as you said, and I'm very, very sorry to hear about your friend Chris. I think, you know, these things absolutely are signposts ultimately and should be used as such to spur us into action, to go out there and, you know, live wildly and do all the things that, as I say, really, really scare us, because I think that's where the growth tends to happen.
Yeah, you've got to get out of your comfort zone, because that's the only time that you grow, you know. And as you get older, you kind of realise that you're playing safe and you say no. And I think that's given me freedom, because I'm, you know, my book it's been called Humorous and Funny. People Laugh Out Loud, which I get people contacting me most days and say, I'm reading your book and I'm laughing around the pool and I burst out laughing on the tube today reading it. And it's really lovely that's there. But I think the reason why people find it funny is because I'm not the I'm not the alpha male in it. I'm not the, I don't get the girl, and I mess up loads. You know, it's all my misadventures, really. And I think people can identify with that, and it's not me trying to be cool. And I think so many people would write a book about that scene, and make sure that their credibility is there. And whereas me, I don't give a damn. You know, I'll get on the stage and I'll tell these funny stories and come up with, you know, poems and songs and just really not care about being cool, because at my age, you know, I don't have to be cool anymore. You know, I've turned 60. You know, and the time for being cool was like in my 20s, my 30s, and my 40s. And so now I just don't give a damn. All my life I've said I didn't give a damn, you know, ever since being a punk rocker. I don't care what people think. But I did care what people think. Now, apart from the audience at Edinburgh and the theatres, I really don't care. And some dance music titles haven't covered the book because they probably think it's very uncool. Because the thing that people miss out on about raving and about clubbing and about partying, as much as there's some great DJs and some fantastic music out there, and really good, you know, Unity vibe and all of that kind of stuff, what many books miss out on is the fact it's a right laugh. It's hilarious. You know, the stories you tell about your clubbing days, everyone's got them. By the guy that was you know, my mate was thrown out of heaven at 1 o'clock because he was seen chewing a pill or whatever, and he was thrown out. So we came out at 3 o'clock, 3:30, and he's there dancing in the alleyway, right underneath the air extractor fan, and went, ah, chill, there you go, no, don't talk, don't interrupt, I love this tune. And he was dancing to the air extractor fan, as if you've been here since you've been thrown out. It's the same. He was there for an hour and a half dancing to the Extractor fan. I mean, hilarious. You know, that's more interesting to talk about rather than the mix that you know, Colin Hood did between Jibaro and, you know, Negreve or whatever it's going to be. You know, it's those kind of stories that's the folklore. That's what we remember. And I think that I'm happy to embrace that kind of foolishness and that kind of uncool thing, because I'm aware that when I got involved in dance music and club culture, it wasn't an industry. I'd book Carl Cox for Rain Dance. And he was like, Carl, what are you doing on the 28th of March? It's a Saturday night. We're doing Jenkins Lane. Yeah, that's fine. What time? You can either do midnight to one, or you can do closing. I'll do closing. That means I do another show in Essex the night earlier. I said, okay, that's fine. 150 quid. No, mate, it's 200. 200. Yeah, I've got an extra deck involved now. Oh God. All right then, 200 quid and an extra deck. Better be worth it, Carl. It was worth it. And that's how easy it used to be. It wasn't an industry. And I think now the industry's grown up, a certain amount of seriousness has crept in. And so, you know, I'm kind of seen as someone that's not quite serious, not quite credible enough, even though my credentials are all to see. You know, I was there back in the day doing that kind of thing. I don't walk around in a black T-shirt looking moody. You know, I wear bright clothes, sunshine clothes. I've got like a Hawaiian shirt with smileys on that I have on stage, and I go out there to entertain. You know, the book is that's what I think why people enjoy it, because I'm not trying to be Mr. Cool, and I think that's really important not to overlook the fact that we go out to party because we want to have fun and we want to unwind and we want to relax and to get loose, you know. And it's important to reflect that and not to lose that. And sometimes, you know, you walk into some nights and everyone's like shoegazing and, you know, not really losing themselves. You know, and I think that's something to be worried about. And that, again, is down to the drug, you know, too much cocaine.
Absolutely too much cocaine, for sure. It's definitely not the drug of choice on this island. Well, it is to a degree, but I think there's a lot of people coming here to do exactly what you just described. And interestingly enough, we were having that conversation the night before last, when we'd obviously been out the night before, we went to Pike's and Bushwhacker was playing, and it was so good. And even though we'd obviously not had a lot of sleep, we all woke up the next day and we were like, I think, yeah, there's a lot of people that go to therapy for like years and years and years and they don't really, you know, make any progress, and, you know, they're still going to therapy. But I think actually just going on a night out and dancing all night long, I don't know, it does something to you. And we're all in just such a good mood, and, you know, that's still continuing. And I think after all these years of working in yoga and retreats, and I didn't go out at all, not once, because I was like, no, not going to go and party anymore. Can't do that and be a yoga teacher. But ultimately, I'm a lot happier, I think, since I started to go back out again and remember the reason that I moved to Ibiza.
Yeah, that's good. That's good to hear. And, you know, I think it's important. I cover in the book that the final chapter is having that drugs discussion, because I wrote it primarily for my sons. I didn't want them to think that it glorifies drug taking, you know, I end up in a mess somewhere. It doesn't ever descend into addiction and rehab and anything like that, which is great. It stays, you know, I keep it together all the way through the book, and it doesn't descend into that kind of thing, which quite often books do. Because really, my story reflects what most people went through in my generation. But most people didn't become addicted to heroin or to crack cocaine. Most people held it together, continued to be parents, held a job together, be fine, upstanding members of society. And occasionally still do that kind of thing. And I think that's important to be a poster boy for that, you know, to recreation drug use. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to gateway to a crack den or an opium den and you know, end up on the streets. It's important to tell the other story. And I think that, you know, in that last chapter called There's No Caper Without Collateral, you know, I talk about the therapeutic uses of psychedelics, about how that's a new area, it's a new field now. And MDMA in Canada, and I think in Australia, is used quite, becoming more prevalent to be used for PTSD and for couple therapy and for trauma. And so, you know, we're at the start of something, I think, here, because it can be used for therapy. you know, mushrooms, you know, psilocybin, LSD, and MDMA can be effective tools in therapy. And I'd like to see some more of that. You know, I think there's it's an exciting time for that. And I think ecstasy's use, don't forget, ecstasy came to Ibiza through the sannyasins. If you want to, I think there's on new Netflix there's a series called Wild Wild Country, which charts how the sannyasins, their ups and downs, and it's the story of the sannyasins, this cult in America with Osho, the spiritual guru, the leader, who had something like 26 Rolls Royces. But anyway, all you need to know is that when there was a raid on their property, and when that all went down, their HQ was busted, and it all started falling to pieces. Some of the sannyasins came over to Ibiza. I think they were known as the Orange People, and legend has it, and it's probably correct, that they brought MDMA and started making MDMA, or certainly started circulating MDMA around Ibiza. So it all came from them. The reason why I say that is that they used MDMA for dynamic meditation, right? So that's what they called it. And if you look at them, you look at these on Wild Wild Country, there's, you know, they've done that dynamic meditation. They would literally for 45, they take some MDMA and, like, literally, I think 45 minutes, just dance and throw off all of their inhibitions. Then they'd lay down for 15 minutes. And then they'd get up again, and 45 minutes they'd dance. And they did this, and this was their dynamic meditation. And they found it a very spiritually enriching thing to do. And so it was used then for therapy, you could say, you know, to help the spirit and to help us through navigate life and to help us discover ourselves and dissolve the ego. That's what ecstasy did. It dissolved the ego, you know, when you were in a big crowd. I describe it in the book. And the audiobook as well. It was great doing those passages for the audiobook, describing what it felt like to be in a crowd. And that's something that when people have talked about the orbital rays before, they've talked about 10,000 people being there and this DJ played and all of that. But I can't quite recall them talking about what it felt like to be coming up on an E in a crowd of 10,000 people with the stars up ahead and, you know, all of that. So we have some sound design in the audiobook as well. The audiobook's just won an award, actually. I was really chuffed, quite surprised, actually. But I won a silver, the Rave New World audiobook won a silver award at the ARIAs, which is the Spoken Word Oscars. And the shortlist included Stephen Fry and Alan Partridge. And I beat them both. I came second. It was like the silver I got, and Alan Partridge got bronze. So I was going to go over to Steve Coogan and go, back of the net.
But you didn't.
No, he wasn't there because I don't think he didn't win, so he didn't turn up to the so I ended up talking to Jeremy Vine afterwards and Nick Grimshaw instead.
Slight downgrade.
Yeah, but the Nick Grimshaw complimented me on my suit, which was this colour, same colour as the I'll show you a picture after the interview. I'd got this suit, and because I thought, what do I go as? I'm supposed to be representing rave culture. I don't want to wear a pinstripe suit. At the same time, I don't want to go dressed in like a long sleeve T-shirt and like a bandana, looking like some cliched, you know, Olympics idea of a raver, an 80s raver. And so I thought, well, a compromise would be to wear a suit, an Italian linen suit that's in the same shade as my book cover, which is bright, well, kind of mustard yellow, with a smiley badge on my lapel.
Very understated. How beautiful.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. We've been talking for a whole hour. Our time is up. Congratulations on your ARIA, the Oscars, audio of the Oscars.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I really appreciate you giving up the time. I know you've been busy today, so thanks for doing this. And hopefully you get some time to read the book.
It's coming to bed with me. Need I say more?
Well... Let's hope it's not a pop-up. Let's hope it's not the pop-up edition.
Reset Rebel.
That's my favourite one. Bye for now.
It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. Coming to you every day.